Today we're going to be looking at Psalm 93. It's an enthronement psalm that celebrates the reign of God over Israel and ultimately over the nations of the earth. Recently we've been studying the role of kingship in the Psalms. We've looked at it as a model for understanding God's right to rule over his people Israel and ultimately over all the nations of the world. In our last class, we looked at Psalm 2. We focused there on the imagery of Jerusalem and Zion. And we noticed that in that psalm, there's an apparent conflict between the promises that were made to David in the Davidic covenant and David's vision of the future, in which he saw a worldwide rebellion against Yahweh and his anointed king. Today we're going to look at an enthronement psalm that celebrates Yahweh's rule as sovereign king over Israel. In keeping with the pattern that I've set during this study of trying to present the core message of the lesson as a theological proposition, today I will say that Psalm 2 teaches us that the sovereign, immutable God of creation is also the holy, immutable God of Torah. In order to set the context for this psalm, and I'm not really here trying to set an historical context, I'm not drawing an historical link between Psalm 93 and the passage that I'm going to read, but I am drawing a cultural context for us so that we will understand the world and the culture and the beliefs of the people into which Psalm 93 was written. So I'm going to ask you, if you will, to turn in your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 18. And we're going to spend just a moment here in this chapter, just sort of getting a context in mind for our study. I want to begin reading in 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 17. It came about when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to him, "Is this you, the troublemaker for Israel?" Elijah said, "I haven't troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have. Because you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you've followed the Baals." Now, I want to stop here a moment, and I want to focus on this phrase, the Baals. Baal is actually an old Semitic word. It's an extremely old word that at its heart means Lord. But it's also the name of a specific Canaanite deity that was worshipped by the people around whom Israel was immersed in their land. And Baal was always a temptation for the Israelites. Here, it's listed in the plural, which is kind of interesting. And I think what he's saying here is that you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you followed the Baals. And the emphasis is on all the places that they would go. The Canaanites would go, and sometimes the Israelites would go to worship this Canaanite deity. So what we're seeing here is that there is an expectation on the part of God, who revealed his will to us, or to the Israelites in the law, and that is, they are being pulled away from that by the culture that is focused around Baal worship. So that's what he means, you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you followed the Baals. "Now then, send and gather to me all of Israel at Mount Carmel. Bring with yourselves 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah." Asherah is a female term, it's a Hebrew word, and it is the name of a female fertility deity, and she was the sometimes consort of Baal. So Baal and Asherah are kind of a team here. So he says, "Bring the prophets of Baal, bring 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." Now, Ahab's big problem, well, he had other problems, but his big problem was his wife. And in this microcosm of the relationship between Ahab and Jezebel, we have a microcosm of the whole issue that Israel faced among the Canaanites. So if we can understand the effect that Jezebel was having on Ahab, she was drawing him away from Yahweh to the worship of the Baals, we can understand the effect that the Canaanites were having on the Israelites. So Baal and Asherah and the prophets who represent them in the Canaanite, among the Canaanite peoples, are said to eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent a message among the sons of Israel, and he brought the prophets together to Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people, and he said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions?" This is important. He's saying, how long are you going to vacillate between two worldviews? How long are you going to move back and forth between what you know to be the revealed will of God and this Canaanite culture that's drawing you away into all sorts of idolatrous practices? So notice what he's doing. He's drawing a line in the sand, and he's saying there are two active worldviews in your world. There is the worldview that is centered around Yahweh as the sovereign king, whose will has been revealed to you in the law, and there's the worldview of the Canaanites, which is in absolute opposition to God's will among you. He says, how long will you hesitate or vacillate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, then follow him. But the people didn't answer a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450. Now, let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves and cut it up and place it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I'll prepare the other ox, and I'll lay it on the wood, and I will not put fire under it. Then, you priests of Baal, call on the name of your God, and I'll call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people said, that sounds like a pretty good idea. That's a literal translation. So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one ox for yourself and prepare it first for your many and call on the name of your God and put no fire under it. So they took the ox that was given to them and prepared it, called on the name of Baal, and they started in the morning. They did this until noon, and they said, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice. No one answered. They leaped about the altar which they had made. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them. And he said, call out with a loud voice. Maybe you're not speaking loudly enough. Call out to your God. He may be busy. Maybe he's gone somewhere. Perhaps he's on a journey. Maybe he's asleep and you need to wake him up. So they cried out with a loud voice and they cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances till the blood gushed out from them. And it came about when midday was past that they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. And then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. So the people came to Elijah. He repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Israel shall be thy name. So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood, and he cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. He's making it a little bit more difficult. Fire and water don't go well together. And he said, do it a second time, and they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time, and they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Then it came about at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and he said, O God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their heart back again. And then the fire of the Lord fell, and it consumed the burnt offering, and the wood, and the stones, and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. Then Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal, and do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon, and he slew them there. The uniqueness of Israel's faith is that it was non-mythological. This is in keeping with the necessity that I've emphasized in this study on grounding our theology, be it Judaism or Christianity, in historical events that shape the way God has revealed himself to his people. Israel's theology came about as the outworking of an objective revelation. And yet Israel was surrounded by a people, both geographically and culturally, who were dominated by a sense of magic and incantations and myth and ritual that was steeped in magical acts. This difference alone means that any study of the faith of Israel must take into consideration that there was a significant cultural conflict in play that traverses the entire Old Testament. And this conflict is portrayed well by the passage that we just read. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, we see a tendency on the part of Israel to assimilate into the pagan culture and the pagan belief systems of the Canaanites. But at the same time, there always were godly men, mostly the prophets, who fought against this form of syncretism, this merging of cultures, recognizing that what the Canaanites were teaching, what the Canaanites were doing, was opposed to the will of God that was revealed to Israel at Mount Sinai. This tendency to assimilate into idolatry surfaced soon after the Exodus. You'll recall that when Moses delayed his descent from the mountain, the people turned to Aaron and they demanded that he make for them a God who will go before us. And Aaron listened to the people, and as a result, we get the molten calf of Cecil B. DeMille fame. We all know exactly what it looks like, don't we? The people made a feast in honor of this calf, and they declared, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." This same idolatrous tendency was exhibited by Jeroboam, who introduced idol worship at Bethel and Dan by setting up bulls of gold that represented Yahweh. It's recorded for us in 1 Kings chapter 12. But the most overt example of this open conflict between the historical faith of Israel and the pagan religion of the Canaanites is found in the contest between Elijah, the prophet of Yahweh, and the priests of Baal that was held at Mount Carmel. We just read it. This is a place where two cultures are in direct conflict. Elijah represents the true faith of Israel. The priests of Baal represent the Canaanite culture. When we understand Israel, we have to understand that within Israel was embodied an ideal. Israel was a nation that was related to God by covenants. Through the covenants, Israel had a special purpose in the world, to be the expression of Yahweh's righteousness on earth among the nations. So they have a ministry, if you will, among the Canaanites. They are to be different. They are to represent the truth, the true faith. They are to represent the righteousness of Yahweh to the Canaanites. Unfortunately, that's not what was happening. Moses had told them this. They can't use as an excuse that we didn't know, because in the 19th chapter of Exodus, he says, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." But this is a purpose to which Israel failed to attain. For Israel's history is a record of conflict. Conflict between the concept of a pure spiritual worship and the pressures that the pagan culture imposed on the people. In this historical context, we should not be surprised that in the sacred literature of the period, Yahweh's absolute right to rule over his people was reflected in what was written. Yahweh's claim on the nation was not the result of years of religious evolution and cultural borrowing that saw a people emerge over time from paganism and idolatry to monotheism, as is claimed by liberal critics. But Yahweh's sovereign kingship was the core of the Hebrew religion, the faith of Israel, from its inception. Alec Mortier, a British scholar and principal of Trinity College, Bristol, wrote something interesting, and it's a little bit long, so I'm just going to read his quote to you. He says, "The story of the Old Testament religion can be told for the most part in terms of a tension between a spiritual conception of God and worship, the hallmark of the genuine faith of Israel, and various pressures such as idolatry, which attempted to debase and materialize the national religious consciousness and practice." We don't find in the Old Testament an ascending from idolatry to the pure worship of God, but rather a people possessing a pure worship and a spiritual theology, constantly fighting against religious seductions, which nevertheless often claimed the mass of the people. Idolatry is a declension from the norm, not an earlier stage, gradually and with difficulty superseded. Here's what he's saying. He's saying from the beginning, Israel had a national consciousness that marked her off as distinct among the nations and served to mitigate against participation in the conflicting religious cultures of Canaan. This environment of conflict created a unique canvas for the biblical writers. To understand the world in which the Old Testament was written, you have to realize that the biblical historians, the psalmists, the writers of the prophetic literature, knew and understood the mythologies of the surrounding people. They understood this. They knew the world into which they were writing. They were not ignorant of the stories of Mesopotamia's chaos monster, Tiamat, or perhaps more significantly, the stories of the Canaanite fertility god Baal and his consort Asherah. They knew these things. And with this in mind, it should be apparent to anyone who reads the Old Testament that it was written with the conscious intent of proclaiming the absurdity of these old myths, proclaiming instead the absolute sovereignty of Yahweh as king of Israel. This polemical thrust in Old Testament literature was a common tool that the psalmist used to contrast the genuine faith of Israel with the myths of the Canaanite culture into which Israel was thrust by the conquest. If you recall, when we studied the 10 plagues in our study of Exodus, I put forth the idea that each plague was a polemic, a theological attack on the gods of the Egyptian pantheon. A polemic is a verbal or written attack on an opposing worldview, and it often makes use of the imagery and symbols of that worldview in such a way as to ridicule it. Often symbols and imagery are borrowed, and then they're assigned new meaning that tends to belittle the culture that's under attack. I believe that this is exactly how we have to interpret Psalm 93. I believe that Psalm 93 is a polemic, a cultural and theological attack on the Canaanite god Baal. It's also an attack on the stories that were circulated around the ancient Near East about this Canaanite deity. Some of you may have heard of a Semitic language called Ugaritic. Ugaritic is grammatically and syntactically similar to a very old version of biblical Hebrew. It was discovered, I think, around the late 1920s when a farmer was plowing his field and his plow struck a stone and he pulled the stone out of the ground and lo and behold, there was a stairwell going down under his field and it contained many documents which turned out to be, the, among other things, the religious body of material about the god Baal, which is kind of interesting. It's like finding the sacred literature of the Canaanites. It's written in cuneiform script, but other than that, there are a lot of parallels with the ancient Hebrew of the Old Testament, and these parallels are very significant in dating and interpreting Psalm 93. So I just want to mention a few things here. Let's think about, first of all, the language of the psalm that we're going to study. If you analyze the language of the psalms in general, that is the entire Psalter, all of the psalms, about 46% of the words that you find in the Hebrew text also can be found in the Ugaritic literature. About 46%. Now the words may be spelled differently. They're certainly written in a different script, but with respect to their origins, they're the same word. So I want to define a term for you that if I don't define it, I will find myself using it whether I mean to or not, so I might as well just define it. It's the term cognate. I've written it on the board up here. When different forms of a word appear in more than one language, these words are said to be cognates. A linguist would tell you that cognate words share a common etymology or origin. An example that might make sense to us as English speakers would be, let's say, the word champagne. Champagne is a French word, but we use it in English as though it were an English word. This may be a better example if we want to stick with our Indo-European languages, and that's the word star. Everyone knows what a star is. In Sanskrit, star is spelled S-T-R. In Latin, it's called aster, A-S-T-E-R. The Greeks wrote aster. And then German, it's stern. But though these spellings are different and the pronunciations are different, star, aster, aster, and stern are all the same words. They're cognates. Being able to trace word origins is an important part of studying ancient Near Eastern literature, and therefore it's important in biblical exegesis. It can be tedious, it can be boring, perhaps, but it's important. So let's do this. Let's apply the science of word origins to Psalm 93, and let's see what happens. Now, I said a moment ago that there's a 46% correspondence in word origins between the Psalms in general as a body of Hebrew literature and the Ugaritic literature. When we do this same analysis to Psalm 93, the correspondence jumps to 75%. It's not quite doubled, but it's a significant increase. So there's a noticeable link between the vocabulary of Psalm 93 and the vocabulary of the Ugaritic stories about Baal. As a side note, there are several other more technical links between Psalm 93 and the language of the Canaanites, but I'm going to spare you even more boring details. But I do want to mention one more, and in my opinion, something very, very important about Psalm 93. There are parallels in the conceptual imagery of the psalm and the Baal stories. In fact, the subject matter of Psalm 93 seems to be a direct challenge to the Baal stories of the Ugaritic myths. It's as though the writer of Psalm 93 wrote Psalm 93 to set the record straight about Yahweh and Baal. W.F. Albright, who is probably the father of modern ancient Near Eastern studies, commented that Baal rose to power, and that's an important phrase, rose to power sometime between the end of the 3rd millennium B.C. and the beginning of the 2nd millennium B.C. And I think what's important about what Albright said is that if he had to fight his way into the position that he held in the pantheon of the Canaanites, then sovereignty was not an inherent attribute of Baal's character. His power was earned by defeating enemies. He did this through centuries of recurring battles, and thus his rule and position was relative, and it was always under threat. The details of Baal's rise to power are recorded in the Ugaritic literature. He had two main adversaries. One was a god called Yom, which I've written up here, which happens to also be the Hebrew word for sea. So in the Ugaritic literature, Yom could refer to the actual sea. It could refer to the water. But it also referred to the god of the sea. He was called the prince of the sea. Sometimes he was called the judge of the sea. So this was the first main adversary of Baal. Then he had another adversary called Mot. But our interest is primarily in the adversary named Yom. One particular reason that Yom is pictured here as his enemy is that there's a story in the Ugaritic literature about messengers that are dispatched to a banquet of the Canaanite gods, and they demand the surrender of Baal to the prince of the sea. That is, the surrender of Baal to Yom. One Ugaritic text reads, "Your servant, O God, is Baal." Now, the God being addressed here is Yom. He says, "Your servant, O God, is Baal. Yom, your servant, is Baal forever. The son of Dagon is your prisoner." This declaration in the Ugaritic text is followed by a battle in which Baal fights with the god of the sea, Yom, and establishes his power over him by winning the battle. But it's not a sovereign power like the power we know from the Old Testament. For this battle must be repeated, it must be fought repetitively, and the fate of this Canaanite deity is always in question. This is the same battle that recurs throughout the ancient Near Eastern literature. It's the battle in which the gods struggle with the sea. This is an imagery that is common throughout the ancient Near East. The gods struggle with the sea because the sea is a symbol of the watery chaos that predates creation. There's another Ugaritic tale that describes Baal's conflict with his other adversary, Mot. In this particular tale, Baal is killed, he's transported to the underworld, and he lies there dead. While he's dead, another god takes over his throne. He's then resurrected, but he finds himself continually in conflict with the gods for his power and his position. And the point of all this is that all of these old myths, in all of them, power is attained through conflict. It's never an attribute of the God, as we understand omnipotence, as an attribute of God's divine nature. So why go into all of this? What does it matter that the language of Psalm 93 and the conceptual imagery of some old fable, how can this be vital to understanding Psalm 93? Well, quite frankly, it isn't. It isn't vital. Believers have read and benefited from Psalm 93 without knowing any of this. But just like knowing the Egyptian background of the plagues enhances our understanding of the Exodus story, knowing the cultural context of Psalm 93 can illuminate and help us understand the message that the psalmist was delivering to his contemporary audience. Plus, it places us center court, if you will, in the culture that the Jews were living in when this song was sung in Israel. And it may also give us a hint as to the psalm's date. Most modern commentators date Psalm 93 to the post-exilic period of Israel's history, namely after their return from the Babylonian captivity, which would be the end of the 6th century. But it makes no sense to me. Ugaritic was a dead language for nearly 1,000 years before the Babylonian captivity ended. So I think these links to the old Baal stories demand a much earlier date. If you look at the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, it attributes the authorship of Psalm 93 to David, but there's absolutely no evidence other than the Septuagint that he wrote this. Nevertheless, it was probably written about the time that David was king in Israel and Jerusalem. So I think I've spoken enough about the cultural background. You kind of understand the world in which this psalm was written. And let's look at Psalm 93. The Lord reigns. He's clothed with majesty. The Lord has clothed and girded himself with strength. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. Your throne is established from of old. You are from everlasting. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their pounding waves. More than the sound of many waters, than the mighty breakers of the sea, Yahweh on high is mighty. Your testimonies are fully confirmed. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, forevermore. Psalms 47, 93, 96, 97, 98, and 99 celebrate Yahweh's sovereign rule over the creation. The psalms that praise his kingship are known as enthronement psalms. If you study these enthronement psalms, you'll discover that one of the reasons that Israel celebrated Yahweh as their king is their recognition that he was their creator. And that's an important link to keep in mind. Both Psalm 93:1 and Psalm 96:10 assert that it was Yahweh who firmly established the world, with the result that it can't be moved. And as the creator, Yahweh has the right to rule over the world that he's made. That's an extremely important point. The creator has the right to rule and to make demands of his creation. If we think in these terms, Psalm 93, 97, and 99 begin with the same phrase. In Hebrew, it's pronounced Yahweh Malach, and it means Yahweh reigns. There's a man named Sigmund Mowinkle who wrote a book called The Psalms and Israel's Worship. He proposed that this phrase, Yahweh reigns, which he translated a little differently, I'll tell you in a moment, that it was a technical phrase that was used for as an enthronement formula at a feast that the Jews associated with Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. But if you look into the ancient Near Eastern material, there's no evidence that such an enthronement celebration was ever celebrated with any of the Jewish festivals. Mowinkle translates the phrase Yahweh Malek as Yahweh has become the king. It's very different. But what's in view here is not a moment in time when Yahweh became the king. What is in view is the theological truth that he is the king. He is the king because he is the creator of both the world and Israel. Yahweh Malek, Yahweh reigns, is a proclamation that Yahweh is the absolute sovereign ruler and the rightful king of Israel. And therefore, we should not translate it as Mowinkle does, Yahweh has become the king, but rather Yahweh reigns. I think something else supports this translation. In Hebrew, we expect to see the first word of the phrase is a verb, and the second word of the phrase will be the noun or the subject. Whenever that order is reversed, it means something. In this case, the first word in this phrase, in this psalm, is the word Yahweh. It's put into what is known as the emphatic position, and it's designed to call attention to the subject of the phrase, which I think keeps in is consistent with the polemical nature of the poem. It's Yahweh, not Baal, who sits on the throne with absolute authority as the sovereign ruler. Alva McLean commented on the phrase, Yahweh reigns, in a book that he wrote called The Greatness of the Kingdom. He said, Psalm 93 is a record of historical fact and refers to a rule of God that was existing in the day when the scriptures were written. If you were to sum up the message of the first two verses of this psalm, our summary would be something like, Yahweh is the supreme ruler who sustains the world throughout eternity. This declaration of kingship, Yahweh reigns, is followed by a declaration of royal grandeur. He is clothed with majesty. The Hebrew word for majesty has the sense of to rise up or to lift up, and it emphasizes the supremacy of Yahweh's kingship. The prophet Isaiah uses this word majesty to indicate Yahweh's sovereign power in judging the wicked. He writes that through judgments, the world learns righteousness. Though the wicked man is shown favor, he doesn't learn righteousness. He deals unjustly in the land of uprightness, and he does not perceive the majesty of Yahweh. So there's an element in this majesty with which Yahweh has clothed himself that shows his intent to deal justly with those who oppose him. He's also girded himself with strength. Strength is a military term used in Psalm 18:39 and in Isaiah 8:9 as preparation for battle. Yahweh has declared war on his enemies. Because Yahweh possesses sovereign power, the world he made is firmly established. Psalm 75:3 says of the world, "It is I who have firmly set its pillars." The world then becomes the theater for the demonstration of God's divine sovereignty. It's in the world that God will establish his eternal kingdom. Verse 2 assures us that Yahweh's throne is established from eternity to eternity. Historically, Yahweh's throne was the Ark of the Covenant, where his glory dwelled above the cherubim. Walter Eichwroth referred to the Ark as the unoccupied throne of deity. Gerhard von Rod concurred. He said, the Ark is the throne of deity, which is left empty. This idea of emptiness speaks of God's invisible nature and the spiritual nature of Israel's worship. Michael McKelvey saw Yahweh's presence on the ark as an act of divine grace in that God would condescend to set to be enthroned there. But I think the throne that's in view here isn't the ark, it's the heavenly throne. The throne in Jerusalem is, in effect, an earthly echo of the heavenly throne that's been and always has been established and will remain established forever. But it's in verse 3 that we really see the polemic come to life. Having established Yahweh's eternal kingship symbolized by his throne, the psalmist then turns in verse 3 to cast ridicule on the old Canaanite myths. The verse reads, "The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their pounding waves." And I think it's at this point that we can turn to the Ugaritic legends to understand what the psalmist is telling us. The noun that's translated floods is a Hebrew word, nahar. It comes from a word that means to flow. A better translation would really be rivers. But if we look at the Ugaritic epics, we find that this same word's cognates, N-H-R in Ugaritic, is an alternate name for the god Yam, which means sea. If you take this is Cyrus Gordon's Ugaritic textbook, which in 1973 cost me $90, if you can believe that. And you go over and you find the Ugaritic word N-H-R. It says it's a river. But then he goes on and he says the phrase, "the judge of the river," or "the judge of the waters," is an alternative proper name for the god Yam. So when we see this phrase in verse 3, that the floods have lifted up, that's the word nahar. What is happening here is the psalmist is alluding back to the Ugaritic stories and is using terms that his contemporary audience would have associated with those stories. What's in view here is the battle between the gods and the sea. The ancient god of chaos, in other words, has raised up his voice. He has raised his pounding waves. It comes from a term that means a military stronghold, and it reaches back to this old tale of Baal and Yam, the anti-theocratic force that opposes Yahweh and his kingdom. But whereas in the Baal tales, Baal battled the sea for his power to rule, Yahweh stands above the floods. He's enthroned in heaven. He's transcendent. He's unaffected by the enemy that caused such distress for this false god, Baal. Yahweh doesn't participate in the battle. He doesn't need to. That fate is left to the pagan gods. The actual proclamation of Yahweh's station above the turmoil of battle is found in verse 4. It says, "More than the sounds of many waters, more than the breakers of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty." In the previous verse, the psalmist has said that the floods have lifted up their voice. Here we read, "But more than the sound of many waters is Yahweh." Many waters in the scripture as a technical term for distress. If you look at 2 Samuel chapter 22, verse 17, it reads, "He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He is indeed our strength in times of trouble." Whatever chaos may occur on the earth, whatever battles the false gods may fight in their pagan mythologies, Yahweh stands above it all, for the Lord on high is mighty. In the closing verse, the connection is made between Yahweh's sovereign rule and his absolute ethical holiness. We read, "Your testimonies are fully confirmed. Holiness befits your house, O Yahweh, forever." The emphasis here is on the content of the covenant. God's covenant, his testimonies, are fully confirmed because he's the one who made it. He's the Lord. He is the one who has committed himself to his people. The theologian T.H.C. Friesen says, "God's holiness implies absolute power over the world, a power that can be like a consuming fire." The psalmist says, "Holiness befits your house." God's house is his temple. But here it seems to transcend any earthly temple to refer to the heavenly throne. I just want to make a few concluding comments, and then I'll take questions. I love the sea. I think we all do. I love to visit the sea. I just got back from Destin. I wouldn't have gone there if I didn't like the sea. I like to sleep with the windows open. I like to hear the waves roll on the beach at night. In our modern era, we've romanticized the sea. Couples go to the sea on their honeymoons. They go on vacations. They walk in the sand. They walk along the shore. It's something we've all done, and I suspect we all enjoy it. But it's only been in recent times that the sea's been viewed this way. For thousands of years, the sea was a symbol of death. You don't find the sea in the old art. You find it only in the last couple of hundred years being romanticized. The beautiful beaches that we now visit, where nothing grows, the beach was always associated with the absence of life. There was always a view of the sea related to death. 3,000 years ago, when this psalm was written, the sea was the enemy of all that's good. The gods were in constant battle with the sea that symbolized chaos. The sea was the enemy of creation. This is the reason in Revelation 21, verse 1, we read, "And I saw the new heaven and the new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea." In the final state, when God has completed his work of reconciling all creation, all remnants of the former fallen world will be eliminated. There's no better way of symbolizing this than by the elimination of the age-old symbol of chaos and anti-creation, the sea. For in all of the old stories, the sea represents everything that's opposed to God. It's anti-creation, and it's anti-theocratic, and in the end, it's gone. In verse 2, the psalmist says that Yahweh's sovereignty is eternal. In the closing verse, he says his holiness is eternal. Yahweh is the creator and sustainer of the world, and thus its preeminent ruler, the king. As the king, he has the right to make ethical demands on his subject. This is affirmed in Genesis 2:16, where the creator commands his creatures to obey one command, not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Here also, the king rightfully demands the loyalty of his subjects by demonstrating his superiority over the evil forces that oppose him. If the king is the creator, and if he is eternally unopposed by the chaotic forces that humbled the pagan gods, then he can rightfully demand from his people that they be holy as he is holy. So what's the theological intent of Psalm 93? By connecting God's sovereign rule to his holy character, the psalmist makes a clear declaration that the sovereign, immutable God of creation is also the immutable God of Torah. Ethics and creation are inseparable. The kingdom of God is a realm in which there's no conflict between what God has done and what he may rightfully demand. In this sense, Psalm 93 opens the theological door to the millennial kingdom in which Jesus Christ will rule unopposed as precursor to the final reconciliation of the fallen world and its holy creator. Now I'll take your question. The question was, when we read the Samuel passage, the word Asherah came up, and I said she was a Middle Eastern fertility goddess. The word Easter probably does come from that, but it's coincidental that the Babylonian feast, which was in the spring, I don't think that use of water is necessarily the same as the use of phrases like the sea or the rivers or the pounding waves. In Scripture, when you see things like the sea rising up, or waves pounding, or rivers coming up and causing a problem, there's a real good chance that's a polemic. We don't see it that way because we don't live in that culture. And that's why I spent so much time talking about this, trying to help you to see what the context would have been for the people who were actually the recipients of this psalm. When the psalmist says that the rivers and the waters and Yam and the sea and all these things are pounding and causing all kinds of chaos, he's going back to those old stories. There are hints of polemic in the creation story. If you think about it, it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. That word is Tehom, and it's a Ugaritic term that refers to this chaotic sea. And then it says that the Spirit of God was hovering above the waters. So it's just kind of a tongue-in-cheek reference back to those old stories to show that all this chaos that predated creation and that characterized the relationship of the Canaanite gods that you're all worshiping, God is above it all. He made it. He's the creator of it. The sea didn't oppose him. He made the sea. That's the idea of the polemic.